For audiences accustomed to operas about noble, mythical, or legendary characters, Carmen came as a surprise. Its depictions of middle-class life, immorality, and lawlessness, and the tragic onstage death of the main character were a bit too realistic at first. But within a few years, Georges Bizet's opera became all the rage, and it has remained so. What made it, and still makes it, such a success? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
How original was Bizet's Carmen? What does it take to bring it to the stage? And how can an old opera be made new? Our guests are William Florescu, general director of the Florentine Opera in Milwaukee, and Dean Anthony, stage director for the Florentine's production of Carmen, which runs October 26th and 28th at Eline Hall.
Welcome to University of the Air and to Madison.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
It seems that Carmen is to opera the way Mona Lisa is to painting in a certain way, that it is the one really well-known opera, and that must make some special challenges. What led to the selection of Carmen for you?
Well, that's always a two-edged answer when you talk about why pick Carmen, because the first answer is, in a sort of very crude sense, people will say cash cow. You know that people are going to come. And that's great. But I think then once you've answered that question and you know that's a reality and boards like that answer, then you've got to know – you still then have to make it fit the criteria which you want to do, which is artistic excellence, musical integrity, and dramatic interest. So we try to answer both those questions in everything we do. But with Carmen, it becomes a bit easier because it's a piece that is beloved today as it was when it was written, or actually more than it was when it was written.
Yeah, apparently.
As Norma just said. So yeah. That's the reason why that I chose it for our season.
Is it one of those operas that has been, you know, reset, you know, for one reason or another?
Absolutely.
Over the years? Has it?
Uh-huh. Yeah, and there was a long period of time where it ended up in El Salvador, Nicaragua. Uh-huh. And it can happen that way, and there's no reason why it can't. But I think the natural setting of it is where it belongs. It's interesting, one of the things you said in your opening that I immediately went to was you talked about the middle class. And personally, I don't see this as middle class. I see this as a much lower class.
There's certainly an element of that, too.
Yeah, you know, you would look at the military. I mean, they weren't paid very much to be in the military at that period. But I do look at these people definitely much more grounded and much more earthy and low in survival. It's a huge part of survival, this piece, to me. It's just the survival of these people and how they survive through life at that period, if you look at the history. It wasn't a good life back then. It wasn't easy.
I'm trying to think if there are other operatic heroines isn't quite the right word, is it, for Carmen, but female protagonists who actually not only are employed, but employed in a very specific and kind of middle or lower class way. She works in a cigarette factory.
Yeah, I wouldn't have to process that for a second to think about it.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, but actually when we're developing a new opera, and actually the character involved actually has that. And I didn't mean to turn this into a plug, but it's just interesting that you mention it. But you're right that this sort of reality theater of a person working in a cigarette factory and making that both a heroine and a femme fatale and an antagonist all in one package is pretty revolutionary when you think about it. Because even as opera was written after that, that's a pretty rich storehouse of things, but a lot of people would have been resistant to that because they like to see characters ennoble the human condition as opposed to reflecting it.
And I think it also helps with us as an audience to be able to associate a relationship with them and connect to them when we see them in the state that it's more of our own living, you know, so people who are work hard for a living can associate with Carmen because they do the same thing. I mean, my head was thinking about a show, and you can go to Marriage of Figaro. I mean, you could go to Susanna, and she's a servant.
Right.
I mean, you want to go into the whole servant thing. That's still of lower class and still of grounded people. People connect to Susanna much more in Figaro than they do to the Countess, you know, and Figaro versus the Count, because that's more of the normal place that we belong.
But I think one of the unique things about Carmen, as opposed to different strata of society turning on each other, a la Figaro, these are different stripes of the same strata turning on each other. The soldiers
right.
and the cigarette girls, Mikhail and her mother, all of them are in a strata society that's similar, but they're in different parts of it, and how they interact and what the tension that comes out of that, I think, is unique, as opposed to the old class versus class, which I think is unique.
Aside from the plot and the classes and so on, you've got the fact that with Carmen, the music is so recognizable. In his Opera 101, 400 Years of the Opera book, Fred Plotkin, who we interviewed here for University of the Air, I think, said, probably no opera can boast more music that is familiar to non-opera goers than this one.
Yeah, well, how many television commercials do have depict? I mean, it's all over the place, and you hear a certain commercial.
Not even cigarette commercials.
That's right.
Do they even do those anymore?
And you know, the irony of it is, though, that one of the criticisms of the piece when it came out was that the music was harsh and hard on the ear, and was considered not very melodic. And you sort of scratch your head because it's, you know, all the different schoolyard versions of the Toreador song, things like that.
Sure.
It's hard to believe today that it was considered challenging in that regard. But I think it's a fair point to say that it's the biggest storehouse of music that people go, I know that. I don't know why I know it, but I know it.
I wonder if we can hear that in the overture. When we listen to the overture to this opera, which tunes get set up?
Well, I mean, what you just played a moment ago. I mean, how can you not get on the edge of your seat and just sit up and go, oh, yeah, something's going to go on here. You know, because it just pops out right out. And it's got that energy in it that sets us up.
I'm trying to remember also, gentlemen, if Carmen's overture is atypical for operas in parading all of these themes, you know, the Toreadors and the fate theme and all that, almost more like a musical would do today.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, you have more of a situation like The Marriage of Figaro where it's a great overture, but it doesn't have any of the tunes.
Right.
This he really does give you the – he gives you the tantalizing bits of it. So I think that – and that could be because of the opera comique, because Offenbach and Gilbert and Sullivan and those types of pieces are much more the predecessor of what we do in musicals. So that's an interesting part of it for Carmen. But it's certainly, as Dean said, it gets the audience, I think –
primed.
Yeah, because if you only hear one part of it, you think, this is going to be a happy show. This is, you know? Yeah. And then you find out, no, it's not. And I think it, the left turns, as he put it, is mimicked very well in the orchestra in terms of what we then see dramatically and vocally with the characters. So,
and especially if you know the piece, if you're familiar with the piece, and you sit down in your seat within the first 8 minutes you're there, you've got all the tunes in your head already.
The other thing that does come into play is that there is a little bit of the Wagnerian thing here with the leitmotif, like with the fate theme coming back and stuff like that. So it's not, it has that musical theater piece, but it also has, I think, the leitmotif, which is a very Germanic aspect to it.
What about nationality here? Because we've got a French composer setting an opera in Spain with an operatic tradition heavily Italian. When you're listening to the music, as in that overture, how do you hear those sort of mixtures of nationality?
Well, I think it's there. I think that they did quite an interesting job of doing that. I mean, Bizet wrote some beautiful, you know, when she says the habanero, and you feel that with the cigarette chorus girls in the beginning, you get this sense of the country. But we're going to talk about this later, I think. But in the opera comique style, you still get the somewhat vaudeville aspect. I have to be careful saying the word vaudeville, but I use that in my own head. But it gets light. There's a lot of lightness in this score of the music, especially when you get to the quintet, especially when you get to Frasquita de Mercedes. The characters are of that opera comique style. And it's really fascinating to work with actors on that, because your first instinct is to go in that light upward feel as an actor. Well, I don't need you to go there. It's still grounded characters within that lightness. That French aspect's in the score, but it's full of rhythm. Of, you know, when she plays the castanets, I mean, you feel it. It's.
But I do think it's still that. This has in common with the Mikado. I mean, Bizet never visited Spain, and even the habanera is based on a piece from Cuba.
Right.
Right.
It has nothing to do with Spain. So it's sort of the. In the 19th century, so many Western countries were fascinated with things exotic, and Spain and the Moorish influence was something exotic. And so it's a snapshot of what French people perceived
Spain to be. Like.
And it's interesting.
That's why we have Don José, for example, instead of Don José.
Right. But it's still a very – I think it's a popular piece in Spain. So I think it doesn't go down to the level of parody, but it is very much a snapshot of what – a Frenchman perceived Spanish to be, which I think is very interesting, because it is earthy in a way that Delibes or Gounod is not.
Right.
Other French composers. Sure. So he did achieve that, but I'm always fascinated when we make a snapshot of what we think another country is.
You mentioned, Bill, opera comique a couple of times now, and you mentioned it first in conjunction with the tradition of the musical. What is it that makes opera comique a thing unto itself, other than just the fact that there's dialogue in between the songs?
Well, I think that's a big part of it. I think traditionally it would have been the level of musical difficulty, though when it comes to Carmen or the Abduction from the Seraglio of Mozart, any of those pieces that are in that style, they have wickedly difficult music, so you can throw that out. And I think the lightness of the story would have been a tradition in opera comique as well, though the comique doesn't truly mean comedy. It means it means stylistic more than mood. But Carmen was a departure from what you would have generally seen at the comique, which, again, I think may have been one of the reasons it didn't succeed. You know, it's like when you take a drink of something and you're expecting a different taste. It's not that that's a bad taste. It's just that you were expecting something
else. It's not what I paid for.
Right. And I think that's why it might have suffered at its inception.
And the audience that was attending that was used to a regular regime of the same structure. And we all get into a structure. And so being challenged was not easy for them right at the beginning.
And it seems so sad that Bizet died just a few months after this was performed or produced, because he would never have known what kind of incredible fame Carmen.
That's pretty. That happens all the time.
Yeah, that's showbiz.
Yeah, it happens a lot.
He fared a little better than Offenbach, though, who didn't live to see Hoffman done at all. So, at least he got to see it.
When we hear this famous, you mentioned the habanera too, Bill, which is, as you say, is a Cuban thing, in the, from the sounds of Havana. When we hear this very famous song, aria, of Carmen, this seductive song, and actually a song describing who she is, really, what are we seeing at this point?
To me, what you're seeing is you're seeing Carmen in her, all of her just normal daily life coming on a break, and her dress is pulled up. She's hot. It's sweaty. She's rolling cigars all day on her legs, and she comes out to have to get away, to get a break. There's a well, and the girls are all mopping themselves and trying to cool off amidst the gentlemen who would love to watch them come out. And so it's very ethereal, and you know, we use the word fumes, we use so much the smoke from the cigars and from the atmosphere. You see them stretching and lunging and reaching in a very slow and sensual, again,
yeah,
sensual
almost like
way.
Ballet, isn't it?
Very much. Very dance-oriented. And rhythm, for me, is huge as a stage director. As a former performer, I find rhythm to be what makes me work as a director. And if you hear that tune, something, it's got depth to it. It's got weight to it. And it makes you want to plie. It makes you want to squat down and sit back and let this text come out of a real smoky and, I'm directing as I'm standing here talking to you.
You know, one of the central things about it is Carmen is just another one of these girls, but the very force of her personality and how she comes across makes her stand out. And so it's really where you see how much that character pops out of the show.
Yeah.
And because it's an homogenous group in some ways, but she pops out of it. And I think the way Dean's staging it, having seen him already work on that, I think that's the atmosphere of it, the tasting the sweat and the dust of the square, I think is going to come across beautifully.
Well, this is Anna Sophie von Otter with that habanera from Carmen by Bizet.
Sur padre.
unforgettable sound of Carmen. We're going to hear more from the opera, including the famous Toreador song, when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, William Florescu, the general director of the Florentine Opera in Milwaukee, and Dean Anthony, the stage director of the Florentine's production, October 26th and 28th, of Georges Bizet's Carmen. Many years ago, I read a slender novel by Prosper Mérimée called Carmen. And it is, I suppose, the major source for Bizet's opera. But there's a considerable amount of difference.
Yeah, a lot of the differences are, to me, from reading the novel, are based on the structure of what was needed to be done for the opera comique. So there are invented characters. There are multiple characters that are in Bizet's Carmen that are not even known to man from the original play.
What about that storyline?
The storyline is, in a sense, it's pretty much the same. It's just kind of inverted differently.
Right.
I mean, the same structure happens. It just doesn't happen in the same exact order.
And the character of Carmen?
She's all there.
What
do we miss if we don't read the novel and we just see the opera? What sort of backstory on Carmen or depth?
Well, the most interesting aspect of the novella is the fact that she's married.
Well, that would change.
To Garcia. And that character is there. And that character is killed by José in the story. And I think there's what we get differently. Mostly, Carmen's pretty structured the same to me in the book when I read it. José's quite different. You really get a sense of his difficult life and the fact that things aren't good for him. He comes from a very, very bad place. And it's interesting. We talked about the Peter Brook version a bit ago before on break, I believe. And that Peter Brook version of La Tragédie de Carmen is, to me, a really great storytelling of the novel. But what I like about the big Carmen is that it gives us this expanded version of it. It broadens out and gives us so many more choices as viewers to watch and to flush out these characters. And you can imagine if there's five characters in a show and then you give them 10 characters, there's 10 more people to enhance the depth of one character, if you understand what I mean by that. That's what I love about the big Carmen. So,
do you, when you see the opera, the Bizet version that you're doing, do you in a sense think José should have equal billing? In other words, it's called Carmen, but a lot of the opera is about José's growth, is it not?
Well, you could ask the person playing José. I'm sure they agree. I'm sure they would agree with that. I don't think so, because I think Carmen is so, I mean, you're pulled to her. I mean, and despite the fact that she's killed at the end of the opera, you never feel that things are happening to her. Whereas with José, you feel like he's letting things happen to him. He's pulled, at least that's my interpretation, he pulls along a little bit. So I think it's very hard to walk away from Carmen and feel like it should have been called José, even though from a storyline standpoint, if you look at it on a storyboard, you could say, gosh, that's more about José.
It is.
But then when you experience it, the music that Bizet wrote and the way a character has to be played, I don't think you can walk away from it without feeling it should be called Carmen.
Absolutely. The arc that the José takes is the most dramatic in some ways, but that arc happens solely because of Carmen. Mm-hmm. It doesn't happen because of anything else. So the fact that she's there is this huge presence that he gets sucked into her whole world. It has to be Carmen. I mean, there's no way around that.
It's not going to be called Escamillo either, I guess.
No, not
Escamillo. The guy shows up twice.
can you give us just a 1-2 sentence plot that would help for those listening who don't remember the roles that José and the others play? Just a really quick, in a nutshell.
Is this going to be a spoiler for people who are going to actually come to see the opera?
Well,
probably not.
Talked about the deaths at the end.
One of the things about, I mean, that I love about Carmen, and I do believe it's so accessible for the audience is that the story takes care of itself for you. I mean, honestly, you almost don't have to read the synopsis in my head to come see this show.
It is pretty straightforward. Not a lot of disguises and trickery.
No, I mean, it puts itself out there. It's very accessible, and you can watch this show. And honestly, you could watch this show, I think, dramatically as well, almost without the surtitles.
Well, and we all are used to love triangles. You know, one woman, two men.
There's more than that.
Yes, of course.
He actually makes it a quartet because he does bring in Micaela, who's not in the novel, to sort of the good angel on his shoulder as opposed to the bad devil on the other shoulder. And then Escamillo, who is important because of what he brings to the story, but as a character is sort of there and gone. But it is so elemental. I mean, it's so, to Dean's point, it's such a part of the human condition. Free-spirited woman draws in a man, takes him away from his good life. He follows her. She's pulled away by some eye candy, and he can't take it. He goes into jealous rage and he kills her. I mean, you could say that to somebody today and say, "Well, I read that in the paper the other day."
Exactly.
Sure.
And that's what's great about it. That's why, yes, you can put it in Brooklyn on a car, or you can put it in Nicaragua. This doesn't need, even if you see Seville in the 1850s as a setting, people get it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the beautiful things about it. It's really making those characters alive, having a director who understands that and making it. And again, having singing actors who can sing the piece, who look the parts and can act it. And I really feel that we have that.
Absolutely.
And I think with all those elements in there and a great orchestra in the pit, which we have, all of those things are there.
And the tremendous, tremendous chorus. Florentine Opera has an incredible core of choristers. So for me, my job is a blessing. I get to work every day with tremendous vocals or principal artists who come with all different versions of this production. I mean, the Carmen, I think she's done 30-plus productions of this, and she knows it. And there are many elements that make my life easier because of that. I mean, she comes in and she sat and played the castanets the other day in rehearsal, and I went, okay, I guess my job's done for that scene. I mean, because it's just so – and again, it's about the rhythm. We talk about rhythms.
Yes. And she was doing some interrhythms on it that I've never even heard before.
Yeah, and she was doing interrhythms, and it's not in the scores. I mean, she has found her way with this role. Now, again, it's interesting because then there's a Don Jose who's done it somewhere else. They've never done it together. So for me, the craft that I get to do with them is an honor, because I get to take the two of them from different worlds of Carmen and put them together and make them one. And that's where my job gets great. And then I have, 36 chorus people and 12 kids that I got to bring in to support what they do. So that's the levels of my job that are just phenomenal.
This is not one of those operas where you have to figure out, oh, how can I make this scene with more action in it? There's plenty of action built into the storyline.
Well, there is.
Isn't there?
There is. But again, as Bill knows me very well, I'm a very active person, and I fight for a tremendous amount of energy. And I expect it from every single person that walks out there. So from the children's chorus to the choristers, because their job as choristers are to feed energy to the artists as they're singing so that.
Can I tell them what your nickname used to be when you were singing? When he was performing, he was known as the tumbling tenor.
I was an acrobat.
Tumbling in a good way. Not stumbling, but tumbling.
He's incredibly physical as an actor, but he's also bringing that to the children's chorus, to the actors. And so you're right, it doesn't need help, but you do need to make sure that you deliver what's inherent in the score. And so many times you'll see this type of piece, because everybody knows it, you get a sleepwalking. A sleepwalking of it. And I don't mean La Sonnambula, but believe me, literally sleepwalking. And so, Dean is meeting the piece where it should be met and making sure that the actors have that interaction to make it happen. So you want to have, when you hear that incredible music in the overture and the tangible and tactile experience you have with that, you can't be let down when the chorus thing comes in and the characters do. Because if you do that, then it's a letdown. And I've been let down in Carmen before, where you have all that buildup with the orchestra, and then you get a flat cardboard performance. And I've been looking at what Dean's been doing in rehearsal. You're not going to experience that at all.
So what's going on when we hear this famous Toreador song with all the warnings in it?
Well, it's a rock star, or say a famous football star, that just walks into the bar. you know? Mm-hmm. And of that ilk, of that period, this is who he was. Escamillo was the top dog. And, you know, he makes this journey to go to Lilas Pastias, you know, to celebrate life. And he walks in, and they go crazy for him. And he walks in, and just like most stars, they want to do a little show for them, you know? So, and it really is. It's that simple in structure. It's about a guy who's got the world by the tail. Escamillo has everything. He's got everything he needs. Money. He's wealthy. He's a great bullfighter. He's got women, anything he wants. And he comes into the tavern and just tells his story about what I like to do. And the chorus feed off him. Talk about energy. It blows off the roof, you know, when he sings this thing. And there's great rhythm in this number, too, because it's not just bashed out there. It just pulls back, and we have different levels of energy. But, of course, then he looks over to the left and sees somebody sitting at a table, Carmen. And, again, then we have another twist in the road. And then things go to a different pace after that, because she just has that much control, which is amazing. And honestly, the simplicity that Audrey Babcock does in that moment, she's our Carmen. You know, there's a whole room full of people who are just, you know, chewing scenery. And there's one person sitting at a chair that is not unengaged. She's not sitting there. She's just watching. That's the counterpoint for me that you will get. You will get when you watch the whole room. And you'll be all excited. Wow, she's just chilling there.
And right. Wow,
she's
above
out.
All of this.
Right, but it, your focus is somebody who's watching will go to that, which I love.
You want the one you can't get.
And watching what Dean does with this reminds me of what used to be said about Maria Callas, is that you didn't necessarily – finding about why she was who she was not so much watching what she did when she was the main character doing something, but was watching how she watched a scene happen. And Dean's giving that a lot of detail. How to this case, a person who's stuck still watching what's happening and how you're drawn to that. That's not that you're not watching the other stuff. But how a character reacts to someone else on stage and to what's happening can be as important. Because so many people on stage, if they're not the center of the action, the shades go down.
They're not doing much.
And how characters react to other characters when that other person has the center stage, I think, is crucial. And watching a little bit what Dean's been doing so far, that's happening. And I think that really gives the scene the richness dramatically that the score has musically. And I think that's crucial.
The reason why I believe that comes out of me organically is as a character person who sang character tenor repertoire for – I was the ultimate sidekick. I played everybody's pal, buddy, or, you know, as when I was just singing and acting. And what I realized back then, my job was to make somebody else look great. If Bill's my Quixote and I'm doing his Sancho, I'm going to give him every ounce of energy so that he is the man. And that was my job. So as a director now, transferring what I did as a performer, it's what I want everybody. It makes perfect sense. So it's been a really great transition for me going from performer to director to use those things I learned as a young singer.
As we hear the Toreador song, this will be Bryn Terfel. Imagine all the visuals that are going on while you're hearing the music.
Señor, señor, cara avec les soldats. Il est torrera, et est sa pour plaisir, il s'en est tombé. Le cirque plaît, c'est jour de fête, le cirque plaît du automat. Et spectateur, elle va la tête, apostrophe, brisez ta page, poussez jusqu'à la fureur, car c'est la fête du courage, c'est la fête des gens de cœur. Alors, conquête, alors, alors,
tor, toreador. Songe bien, oui, songe un combattant que l'œil noir te regarde et que l'amour t'attend, toreador. L'amour, l'amour t'attend.
Well, as I say, a lot going on there, both visually, which you imagine, unless you're at the performance, and musically, too.
When it's a performance, you'll hear cheering beyond cheering for this guy. You know, you don't hear that in a recording nearly as much as you would see in a live production.
I assume you see him swaggering or just looking...
Swaggering?
Or,
oh, yeah.
Yeah. Puffed out or...
Yeah, he's showing, he's pulling his cape off and he's giving us a little demonstration of the toreador. Yeah, absolutely.
Great stuff.
And all how the women like him, all of them in the room.
And yeah. Carmen is just watching.
And she's just watching.
We'll look at Act 3 of Bizet's Carmen when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guests are from the Florentine Opera from Milwaukee, which is going to be staging George Bizet's Carmen October 26th and 28th. We have with us Dean Anthony, the stage director, and William Floresco, the general director. We just heard the famous Toreador song.
Right.
Get us back into the opera and what happens. Mm. You know, how does our José then respond when he comes on the scene? We've heard the beautiful voice.
Well, in quick terms, Escamillo meets Carmen quickly, fascinated by her, but yet he takes off pretty quickly and he goes back. And then we have José who comes in, who has been in prison because he, earlier in the production, he falls for her and helps her escape after she has cut someone in a fight scene in the opening act, in the fight between Manuelita. So he's now been released. So he's coming to see her, and they meet. They have a wonderful reunion, and then the bugle starts to chime for him to go back to the barracks, and he opts to go back to the barracks, which does not please Carmen too much, and the tension starts to flare, and this is where we start seeing both of their tempers start to flare, which is a big shift for the production, for the entire opera, to me. And then she finally just says, I've had it. And then he actually starts to show his aggression and some dramatic physical action happens. And then he realizes what he has done and she's quite shocked by it. And then he sings this aria.
Boy, hearing the music fade makes you want to come and see the whole thing, sure. Doesn't it?
Exactly.
That was Robert. That was Robert Alagna, by the
it's
way.
It's kind of painful when it's, oh, the music stops.
Flower song from Carmen. Well, it's dramatically, it would be a challenge after the, you know, Escamillo scene that we've described, where everything is just like going off the top and everybody is excited and you have the big chorus, then dramatically, as they say, it's a tough act to follow.
Well, actually, it really isn't. If you come to the show, you'll see. That was a good plug.
Plug number four.
Where we go, I mean, there's a lot that happens between Escamillo's aria and this aria of Don Jose. There's a whole wonderful setup scene with the welcoming of him back, and she dances for him, and that's a great setup. But then it shifts, and it was a wonderful experience yesterday. Noah Stewart, our Don Jose, we staged this scene just yesterday, so it's really fresh in my mind. And as we were talking about it and working on it and finding it, you know, the real trick for this number, for this aria, is not to have Don Jose go to a too melodramatic place, you know, because if you listen to the music, it's so lush and it's almost like you want to see somebody break down and start to cry. And Don Jose is not a crier, you know what I mean? So, but what you get from it is the brokenness of this man and how Carmen has the power to break you, to break someone. And that's what we see. That's what we find in this moment. And Noah's tremendous. He brings a lot to the table and is really open and did some wonderful work yesterday. So I think he'll blow you away.
But he's obviously a dangerous individual despite the soft, tender, lyrical side.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Because, I mean, you even in the knife fight that he and Escamillo have, I mean, in a lot of ways he gets the – I mean, he's equal to the – to the fight with this guy who's a dangerous bullfighter, so he's no wimp.
And if you go back to the novel, I mean, there's the reason why he's in the service is because he killed somebody and they shipped him off to get his act together. You know what I mean? Uh-huh. I mean, so there's a lot of levels that, you know, that don't show up in the Bizet.
And what I'll say about Noah is, in addition to being a wonderful singer and actor, he makes you want to go to the gym. So
he's a very wonderful. He's a great physical presence, just innately. Yeah. He actually has tremendous control of his body, and it's really great to watch that, and to see him use his body as an actor. You know.
And how do you handle the scenes between him and Carmen in terms of the violence toward her?
You just have to be safe and be smart, and I choreograph it. Mostly like a dance, stage combat-wise. I mean, the grabs, all the tosses and all the pushes are incredibly carefully thought out, because it can get violent and you're, you know, emotionally wrapped up in the music. But safety is the most important thing. It has to look to you as the audience member so that you go, wow, that's what we're aiming for. But on stage, it's nothing but safety.
And 'cause when you physicalize, it's like when you sing, you have to keep the outer shell of what you're doing. But to be able to sing opera and put across those emotions, if you connect to it too much at a basic level, you can not be able to sing. And it's the same thing with physicalization. You have to leave the shell there that allows you to do it. But you have to be able to pull back, because there's plenty of examples. Domingo and Stratus come to mind at a Pagliacci, where if you don't do that, people can get hurt. And this is an opera where that definitely could happen.
What do we find in this final duet?
No, it's not good. We just basically, up to this point, Carmen has, she's moved on. And she's actually moved up, as I would say.
Uh-huh.
She's now
Jose.
Well, she's now with Escamillo. And I think this is a good thing for Carmen in some ways. It's interesting. I mean, she's moved up into this. She's moving up the chain, so she's going from the lower level guys, and she's kind of.
Jose has kind of given everything for.
Well, he gave it up, and he's gone, so we don't know where he is. Yeah. And I look at it that way as a director, that Carmen has said, this is a nice place to be, and I stage it that way. I bring her in with Escamillo in this, and so she's a part of the procession at the top of Act Four. She gets to show off her new mantilla and her new dress, and she looks great.
Though I believe if she didn't die in this duet, I don't think her travels would be done.
She'd move up from Escamillo. The King of Spain would be next.
I think she'd keep moving.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I don't think she's got the patience to be with anybody for too long.
Yeah.
But she'd find something in each person. But so what happens is there's the big procession, there's the big bullfight, and and everybody's in, and then the Frasquita and Mercedes come to her and say, "We just saw Don Jose sneaking through the crowd." So he's gone out to look for her, and he's pretty broken at this point. So when we talk about fate, in the book, if we go back to the novella, she knows. Because we even talked about that, but she does the cards.
The cards, right.
I mean, she pretty much knows that this is going to happen. So I think the part of the Escamillo allure is that she's going to live it the best as she can.
And I think she sees her fate as liberté, which she talks about in the Smugglers. For her, liberté is important whether she's dead or alive, and mm-hmm. she's not going to give that up.
Right.
And so she's accepting, I think, of that fate. She'd rather have that
exactly.
than not. And
give me liberty or give me death.
Exactly.
Sure.
Exactly.
But which sets up a great counterpoint when Jose does come in.
Yeah.
So you have, she said, I was expecting this in some form or another. He shows up. He's broken. He's just broken. And what he does is he gets desperate. And inside of his desperation, we hear the ensemble singing, screaming for Toreador, which just gets in his head. I think that's the way he wrote it. It's so yeah. interesting because I feel like the cheering for Escamillo is his brain just getting more and more. It's full. And finally it gets to the point where it just explodes. So
final duet from Carmen.
Come on, sir.
That was Agnes Balza as Carmen and José Carreras as Don José in the final duet from Georges Bizet's 1875 opera Carmen. And with us for this conversation of University of the Air have been the general director of the Florentine Opera, William Florescu, and also the stage director for the Florentine's upcoming production of Carmen, Dean Anthony. And those productions, again, will be taking place October 26th and 28th at Eline Hall. And thanks for being with us.
Pleasure.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air.